I'm David Manilow, and welcome to The Dining Table, a place where we gather to share the good things in life. In a minute, I'll share my pick for the best Chicago restaurant to open during 2022. We'll head to the Crane's newsroom for a chat with Ali Marotti about a costly scam that's hitting restaurants. Plus, Farmers Fridge CEO Luke Saunders tells us why he thinks Chicago is the best place in the world for food entrepreneurs.
Yeah, I mean, so for years and years, I was like, this isn't a vending machine, right? It's a restaurant. And everyone was like, you're nuts. It's clearly, very clearly a vending machine.
So it's December, and we're coming to the end of 2022. So I want to tell you about what I think is the best restaurant that opened this year in Chicago. I think it's a place that has it all. Splendid food, a fine wine list and cocktails, nice surroundings, really lively energy, a personable staff. It's a restaurant that allows you to have a great time, which I think is so important. And it's called Obelix. Obelix is run by Oliver and Nicholas Poulevet, whose family started Le Bouchon in Bucktown almost 30 years ago. So since Oliver and Nicholas are brothers, I'll call Obelix Le Bouchon's older, more sophisticated brother. It's tucked away at 700 North Sedgwick, in the River North, kind of near North neighborhood. It's really isolated. It's very French. You can get dressed up, but you don't have to. It's somewhat expensive, but it's an a la carte menu, so you can control your costs a little bit. I went on Saturday night with my wife and one of her best girlfriends. We got there at 7:30 for an 8 o'clock reservation, so we went to the bar, and I ordered a Sazerac, something I've never done because Sazerac comes with cognac, and I just figured I'm in a very French place. I'll have something with cognac. I figured it would be good, and it was. When we sat down and ordered dinner, we looked at the menu. They have a raw bar with oysters and caviar, mussels, shrimp cocktail, lobster, everything from duck consomme and a salad lyonnaise to a very, very expensive beef Wellington, which we did not get, a bavette cut 16-ounce ribeye, a pot-au-feu, which is also a kind of like a corned wagyu brisket dish. But we got some steak tartare, which is excellent, and also Moroccan-style carrots, which are heirloom carrots with a preserved lemon yogurt. Really, really good. For entrees, we got a seared black cod with sweet potato, also steak frites, and what I got was something I've never seen or ordered before, was a squab pithivier, which is basically a poultry pot pie with foie gras, confit, and a sauce of Madeira wine and truffles. So if you're into squab and you want a little young pigeon, if you go for that kind of thing, I would definitely recommend it. For dessert, we had an opera cake. I ordered a sidecar at dinner, which is another cocktail with cognac in it, kind of continuing the theme. I was having such a good time. And my wife and her girlfriend ordered six separate glasses of champagne over the course of the dinner. And I'm like, why wouldn't you just order a bottle? But I realized what was happening. They were having such a good time that every time the waiter came over, they just said, yes, and another glass of champagne. Oh, yes, and another glass of champagne. So this is a really great place for the holidays. I think it's a special spot. I'm super happy for the Poulevet brothers. If you'd like what I'm describing, I think you'll have a lovely time at Obelix. Food and restaurant reporter Ali Marotti joins me now with the latest on the food and restaurant beat. Hey, Ali, how's it going?
Hey, David, it's going good. We got a lot to discuss today.
So let's get up to speed.
All right. So first and foremost, Michelin star Elizabeth is closing later in December. And that's the one up in the Lincoln Square neighborhood. It's about a decade old. They do the tasting menu, obviously. You know, the chef that started it a decade ago, she was really into sort of foraging. She grew up on a farm in Indiana, a small farm. So she's built those roots into it. Self-taught chef. Very interesting.
Ileana Reagan.
She left about a year ago. There's a new owner who actually bought it from her in 2020. And he is staying, and he is opening a new restaurant in the same space there on Western Avenue. So do not fear for those that love that space.
And it's called Atelier?
It is, which means artist studio or workshop. He told me that they're searching for a new chef now, and whoever they end up picking will sort of dictate what the cuisine is going to be. But it will be fine dining. They will stick with the tasting menu.
It's an interesting location. It's kind of like a little hidden. There's not much around there. They've always kind of done elevated food there. So it's an interesting to explore. I did go to Elizabeth when it was in the foraging stage. It was interesting, but I only did go there once. But there's also a story that you covered on, I think it's called Friendly Fraud at Restaurants. What's that all about?
So this is a story that I've been working on for a few months, and I'm excited to get out there because it's fascinating to me. Basically, friendly fraud is when you, in this case, go to a restaurant, eat your meal, don't complain or send anything back to the kitchen, but then within a few days, you call your credit card company and report the charge as fraud and request your money back.
Now, who are these people? This is what I've read your story, and I'm like, are these people professional scammers, or do they really feel like, hey, I didn't get the value that I think I deserved by dining here? I just don't understand it.
Great question. And I think it's probably both, right? So first of all, you see scams such as this increase during economically difficult times, like the one we're in right now, experts tell me. Second of all, you know, there are forums online about this, which I hate to say and point people toward, but some of these restaurant owners are saying, you know, the word spreads among these scammers. But I think also what's going on here is that throughout the pandemic, everybody started buying everything online. I mean, most people were doing that before, but it just really became ingrained in our habits, which means everybody got a lot more comfortable with, you know, checking their credit card statements to make sure they weren't hacked. And if they saw a charge they weren't familiar with, you know, running that up the flagpole to their credit card company and saying, hey, this wasn't me, or hey, my product didn't get delivered, or it was damaged when it did get delivered. Credit card companies on their end have made it very easy for people to do that because they want it to be seamless. A lot of times it's automated nowadays, you know, because that was just another pandemic thing that happened, right? You just make it really easy for people to do this. So I think people understand that side of it better and maybe don't understand, experts tell me, that this money, when you do that, it comes right back from the restaurant, right? I mean, it's not your credit card company. They don't have this big cat like cache of money somewhere. Hey, this person got frauded. Let's give them this money from our big bank.
Right.
No, it's coming right out of the restaurant's pockets, which is rough for them.
From what I understand in your story, even if the restaurants fight it and win, they're still getting charged a fee by the credit card company.
Correct. They're getting charged, it's typically around $15 to $25, I'm told. And that doesn't sound like much, but for a restaurant, their margins are very, very slim. It's 3 to 5% margin. So if you think about that, you know, it's if you're getting charged a $25 fee, which they have to pay even if they do, if they win the case and get their money back. But the margin on that meal is so small, right? Like it would have had to been hundreds of dollars for it to make it worth it. So, you know, I talked to restaurant owners that said, we don't, some of it's interesting, right? Some of them, we don't fight it unless it's over a certain threshold. Some of them say, I hate this so much. I do everything I can to fight it. I don't care how much money I lose and how much time I spend on it, you know?
Right.
But it seems to be online purchases are worse. That's one of the reasons why this escalated so much. And I should say that it's quadrupled since the pandemic hit, the incidences that we're seeing of this. And because so many restaurants started selling food online, that's another reason why it's gone up so much. But this is happening, you know, in person as well, which is the fascinating part.
That is fascinating. But the online stuff apparently has been going on forever when it comes to like retail operations. And now it's just kind of shifting over to restaurants because of so much. And do the delivery services, if a delivery service is the intermediary, how does that interplay into the whole
thing? Great question. So I reached out to all the delivery services and it basically depends on which delivery service. They have, you know, different rules. Some of them will, because they collected the money, they are the ones that give the money back. You know, they just do it differently, right? Some of them do the fighting themselves. Some of them don't. They pass it back to the restaurants. It just sort of depends. The restaurants that are most at risk here are the ones that are doing their own online sales, is what I'm told.
Because they don't have a buffer.
And they don't have, you know, a lot of the know-how to fight online fraud, which is very, very rampant these days.
It's terrible. All of it's bad. All of it's bad.
It's bad. The whole reason that I was turned on to the story in the first place was I was talking to a restaurant owner many months ago about a different story. And he was like, you should write about this friendly fraud situation. And here's an example. And he said that basically, this is a restaurant over in the West Loop. he had a couple come in. He assumed it was a first or an early on date. And the woman made the reservation, but then they split the check and they both ate their meal. Nobody complained. The next day, the man reported his charge as fraud. So the restaurant owner called the woman who had made the reservation because he had her phone number and was like, hey, was something wrong with the meal, you know? And she was like, no, my meal was great. I don't know what's going on with him. We were on a first date. I don't know him that well, you know? And he would like explain to her what happened. And I was like, I hope you told her not to go on another date with that guy, you know? So that kind of stuff is what's happening. But it's also, you know, I talk to restaurants in River North that if they get this on bottle service, it's thousands of dollars. And that I think seems to be you know, a really big issue for places. So,
right. Yeah. Well, let's hope it subsides or the credit card companies figure out how to deal with it a little bit better than just, you know, making it automated so anyone can do it. Okay. Third story is there's a relatively new reservation system where you can book better tables at a restaurant for a fee. I have a lot to say about that, but explain a little bit more on it.
I'm excited to hear your thoughts. But yeah, so it's called Tables with a Z, and it integrates right into the restaurant's website. So this isn't something like an Open Tables where we as consumers have to go into a different website. You go right into the restaurant's website. So here in Chicago, Gene and Giorgetti uses it, and Rocca Accor, the Japanese steakhouse in River North. So at Gene and Giorgetti, I think it's a good example. They only put two booths on there because, as we all know, not every seat can be the best seat in the house. So they've got their Frank Sinatra booth, which, you know, kind of speaks for itself. And then they have another VIP booth where a lot of other celebrities have sat. I guess everybody was always asking to sit in those booths anyway. It's $25 if you want to sit there at 8 o'clock on a Friday night. It's only $20 if you want to sit there at 6 o'clock. Now, if you want to sit there before 5 p.m. on a Friday night, you don't pay anything, right? So you see that, which is sort of interesting because it's restaurants also using it not only to make extra money. This is money straight into their pockets. It's a new revenue stream, which they are really happy about right now as their costs soar with inflation. But it's also encouraging people to eat kind of in those off hours, you know, so not everybody's hitting all at once.
And Frank Sinatra probably ate at 5 o'clock as well. So it's like
maybe his pre-show snack.
Right. You can recreate that experience for yourself.
And at Rocca Accor, interestingly, I asked, you know, well, what's your hottest table? Because they've got more than just two. I'm told that one of the window seats, the two top that's, you know, sits next to the floor to ceiling window is good for probably like a date night situation.
If you go back last decade or so, there was a couple of reservation systems. It was basically an online marketplace for reservations at the really hot restaurants. So you'd have to pay this third-party service to get your reservation. Those all failed. Okay, you could see them working maybe a little bit in New York or whatever, those all feel. I can understand booth one, if the pump room was still there. I can understand the Gene and George Eddie's thing. But I think there's a reputational risk to the restaurants if they're making this kind of widespread. Because if I saw that as an option where I have to pay for better tables, I'm looking at it differently. I'm looking at it as like, oh, I'm just getting an inferior table, right, when I don't pay. And I'm not really, that's not how I want to start my experience with a restaurant, saying you're getting of lesser value. Now, here's what I do think. I think there's an opportunity, and this is where this reservation system may go, where if they say, hey, this table at 7:30, 8 o'clock on a Friday night or a Wednesday night comes included with a glass of champagne, and it's also the best table in the house, where they're actually giving me something other than the real estate of the table, I can see that. I can see that disguised, right? Because I feel like I'm getting something special. So when I come over there, I'm treated a little differently versus I'm just paying for better real estate. And I understand their argument. Their argument is, oh, you pay for a better seat at a theater. You pay for, you know, on United Airlines. I know you use Delta, but United is our hometown airline, so I'm going to use United. I just think restaurants it's too much of a social experience. It's too much of a community endeavor for me to want to kind of like look at that place and say, all you want to do is upsell me before I even get there.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're right. And I spoke to an expert about this and he agreed with you. He didn't think this would necessarily take off, or if it does, it would be like, you know, an Open Table mimicking it. But his point was, this already goes after, you know, people that have the money that aren't looking to pinch pennies right now because of inflation. Maybe somebody that's doing a special occasion, right? Like you, it's your anniversary and you want the table you had your first date at, something like that. But his point was, that is not enough to make this catch on. And my question to him was, is this going to be the new norm? Are we going to all have to pay for every table we want to sit at? And he was like, no, I don't think that's going to happen.
I agree with everything you're saying. My point is, and I don't know who you talked to, but it is, there are going to be people out there that happily do it. The question is, which restaurants are going to do it, right? Which restaurants are going to, I've mentioned this before, but I went to a semi-fancy prefix place that I booked on Tuck, and we went with another couple. And when we got there, we ordered we ordered two of the four wine pairings because we didn't want to drink that much wine. And when we got there, the whomever waiter, whatever, said, would you like the upgraded wine? And we're like, no, we feel like, no, we're cheap. We've just, you know what I mean? I don't want that relationship with a restaurant. I want to kind of like, I just don't want to feel like that I'm constantly being upsold, and now upsold at the time of the reservation.
That was definitely my question for the restaurant owners that had incorporated this. And I talked to the guy who started the company Tables, and you know, the restaurants say, we don't have every table on here, so you don't have to do it. Also, this argument that with the founder said to me was, you know, you don't get mad at the Bulls for having courtside tickets. You don't get mad at United for having first class. I do think there's a little bit of a difference there, though, because, you know, at a restaurant, you're not paying to sit there. Like you already have to buy your ticket to the Bulls game. You already have to buy a ticket to sit on a plane. You don't have to buy a ticket to go to a restaurant. You know, you're choosing what you're going to eat there, and you're paying for the food, not for the seat.
Right. Good point.
So that, I mean, that is a difference, but we'll see what happens. That right now there's just a few of these on here. Roca Accor, interestingly, they started it at their location in San Francisco first because they were like, hey, it's a tech town, let's try it.
Sure.
They said it's brought in a lot of money and it's done really well. And they expect to bring in about an extra $5,000 the first year they have this here in Chicago, but they think it'll double. And then, you know, the tables, the company sort of helps them decide how much to charge for each table. Right now, I think they're only charging like $5 to $20, $25. It's not astronomical, but the Tables folks told me that some restaurants around the country that use this charge up to $100 just to pick your table.
I will say this, the curmudgeon-y part of me doesn't like it at all. So I'll leave it at that.
Well, report back if you try it.
Okay. All right. Allie, great talking to you. I'll see you next week.
Yes, thanks for having me.
I'm here with Luke Saunders, the founder and CEO of Farmer's Fridge, which is a great entrepreneurial food story. Hey, Luke, how's it going?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So a while back, you're like a sales guy. You're traveling all over the place and you have an epiphany over like a stale granola bar and some popcorn that you, I assume, found in some vending machine. And now 5 million jars of salads and wraps and bowls later, you're in 500 plus locations around the country. Give our audience a little bit of taste of what Farmer's Fridge is all about.
Yeah. So really, Farmer's Fridge, the idea is pretty simple. It's to make fresh, healthy food as accessible as a candy bar. So I had this job where I was driving 1,000 miles a week across, you know, multiple states, and the only options were fast food and that stale gas station meal. I've always loved food. You know, had a vegetable garden with my mom growing up, and was very surprised by how few options there were on the road. And just thought, you know, this could be better. I could make food in one place, and I could sell it in vending machines. There's no reason this food has to be stale and gross. I have since learned there are a lot of reasons why that's very hard. but the idea was, you know, if you want to do it, you have to build a business model around that product. And so we make fresh food every single day. We cut whole ingredients. We're making dressing from scratch. And then we have our own refrigerated trucks that actually deliver all of that food to the fridges and retail stores now too. We've expanded into Target and Jewel and other places.
You had to, I assume, build your own vending machine. Is that correct?
Yeah, more or less. So like I went to the vending machine show in Las Vegas before I got started. I found out there was like a trade show and
who knew?
Yeah, exactly. There's a trade show for everything. So I got there and I actually walked the floor and I found like a vending machine touchscreen that had pictures of salad on it. And I was like, this is incredible. This is exactly what I'm trying to do. Can this machine sell salad? And they're like, well, no, of course not. It has no refrigeration. So like, well, you know, this is like a concept. We're trying to get people excited about the idea that you could merchandise different things, but we can't actually sell all of these things. So I had to find a refrigerated machine that would be flexible enough to vend our products. And then we found some software off the shelf. And then we actually worked with some reclaimed wood guys based in Batavia, Illinois, to build like a house around this thing. So it was basically a vending machine constructed on site in the Garvey Food Court in downtown Chicago. And we still do a version of that today. So we buy like an off the shelf vending machine. We actually do all the software and electronics now. And then we designed a box it's like a piece of IKEA furniture that we build around to make it a better experience.
That's awesome. And from the idea to getting it off the ground, what was that process like? And it must have been super exciting, your first customer. Tell me about that as well.
Yeah, so I loved food. I was qualified from that standpoint, but I didn't have a restaurant background or a food background. So I was living in Ann Arbor at the time. We knew we were moving to Chicago. I actually volunteered at a cafe, even paid the owner a little bit of money, to ask her a bunch of questions about how all this worked. I went to a soup kitchen and just tried to get experience working in kitchens. And then when I moved to Chicago, I was able to get set up in a shared kitchen here on the West Side, about a block from our current office called Kitchen Chicago. And I actually learned more from working in a shared kitchen than anything else, because I could ask the other operators, food trucks and caterers, and we operate very differently today, but it was really just, okay, I know I want to sell food in a vending machine, worked on how do you make it, what are the recipes, and then built the vending machine. And it was really just a proof of concept. Half the people I told about Farmer's Fridge at the beginning told me this was nuts. Nobody would ever want to buy food from a vending machine. It's gross. And they're sticking to their restaurant purchases. So I just wanted to put it in a food court and see if they had the option of a restaurant or a vending machine, would they pick a vending machine? And once we got that proven, it was all about how do we build this business to scale it up? And now we serve 20 markets and over 500 locations for the fridge.
And how did you come up basically with the idea of a jar? Because people aren't used to necessarily eating things out of a jar. I know it's becoming more popular, but what was that like?
Yeah, the jar was actually a really funny story. I was very against the jar. So I had my brother-in-law sent me some photos on Pinterest. He knew I was working on this business. And he said, I saw the coolest thing. It's salads in a jar. You should put your salads in a jar. And I said, Josh, I don't think that's a good idea. I've already got to convince people to buy food from a vending machine. Then I'm going to have to convince them to eat it out of a jar. That's crazy. I can't do that. And so I spent a few months trying to design packaging, and I couldn't afford to customize anything. So I was buying all this off the shelf packaging from Restaurant Depot and on the internet and trying to figure out how to merchandise it well. And I eventually just got so frustrated because it all looked like crap. You know, you have to merchandise it vertically in a vending machine. It's not sitting down, and most packaging is designed to be flat.
Right.
I went to Walgreens or somewhere. I bought a dozen ball jars and I started filling them with salad, and I took photos and I sent it around, and I actually sent a photo to my mom, and she was like, that is beautiful. What is that? And I was like, oh, shoot, I should have listened to Josh. That was it. And from there it was if people aren't interested in trying the food, if it doesn't taste good, it won't matter. So we'll figure out how to get them comfortable with the jar next.
And the jars are good. You know, we had a couple of jars at home, and I think we saved the jars and repurposed them for something else. They're cute little plastic jars.
Yeah, no, honestly, people love the jars. Once they try it and they get over that hurdle, we have plates at the fridge, so you can dump it out and eat it just like a regular salad. It helps you shake it up. It keeps it more fresh. And it's a ton of food in there. It's actually packed in. So when it opens up, people are very surprised. But yeah, I found that when I was doing recipe testing, I would drop off the jars at friends' houses. And I would come back a week later to ask, how did it go? And what did you think? And I'd see the jars all over their kitchen with crackers and cereal and dog biscuits. And I was like, wow, this is an incredible marketing opportunity. If we print our name on the jar, we'll have a little billboard in your cupboard forever.
Right.
And people have sent us all kinds of cool ideas of what they've done with the jars over the years.
So these are perishable items because they're basically salads or wraps or bowls. And so the process must be interesting, especially as you've expanded into other cities, of getting the salads created, bowls created, sending them off to the vending machines and having them turn over fast enough where people are going to buy them within whatever their sell-by date.
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole business. So the idea at the beginning was, let's start with the freshest, highest quality product that we can at an affordable price point, and then we'll build the business model around serving that product. So I remember I wrote the business plan. I sent it to a few people. One of them was my father-in-law. He called me up. He said, you know, maybe this could work, but you know, you're not going to sleep at all. Like, this is going to be like a 24-hour a day gig. And I was like, I guess, like, if that's what it takes, I'll figure it out. And he was 100% right. So we literally are making fresh food every single day. Then we're getting it shipped out to get it to the fridges that same day. Then we have to like clean and reset everything. So it's been a 24-hour operation basically since I started. And that's one key ingredient, is we do everything. We actually get whole ingredients in, we process them, we assemble it, and we get that product out the door that day and into a fridge. And so just shortening the time from when you make something to when you get it to somebody. But we also do a lot of iteration around like, what is the way to make this product taste the best over time, down to like, how do you cut the lettuce? Do people notice? And so it's really a lot of investment into the quality of the product. But then the other side of it is technology. So we knew in order to get this to work, we'd have to have real-time inventory visibility. So we built that into the fridges so we could actually see what's available everywhere. And then as we grew, it got so complicated to manage that manually that we built an algorithm that essentially all the food we make today, we don't know where it's going, or most of it. The algorithm will look at the inventory of the 500 plus locations and then recommend where to send everything. And then we have a team of people that pack all that up and get it out the door at like 6 or 7 o'clock tonight. So it's really, it's the whole business, to be honest.
It's amazing. Logistics and data, right? I mean, it's
exactly
over everything. It's crazy. And now you're doing some collaborations. I know you have been with some pretty well-known chefs.
Yeah. I mean, so for years and years, I was like, this isn't a vending machine, right? It's a restaurant. And everyone was like, you're nuts. It's clearly, very clearly a vending machine. Which was fine. Like I understood that. But it was really a way to try to get people to reconsider that vending machine stigma. And eventually we were able to get recognized as the world's smallest restaurant. And right before COVID, and so like took 7 or 8 years, but we got people to acknowledge, okay, this is different than a vending machine. But then we got completely shut down by the COVID impact. We lost 87% of our revenue in 2 weeks. And we're thinking about ways that we can adapt. And we reached out to some local chefs in Chicago and said, hey, you're probably not very busy right now either. Would you like to come up with some recipes for the fridge? And then we could put them in there and donate the proceeds to charity. So we started with Paul Kahan in 2020. And we've worked through a list of really incredible chefs. So everyone from, you know, Rick Bayless to Stephanie Izard, Andrew Zimmer, and Missy Robbins, and Bill Kim here in Chicago. And then right now we're running one with Neelu Motamed. So that's actually raising money for UN Women. And it's been an awesome program. But what it really did is it helped confirm that this is restaurant quality food, right? Celebrity chefs and some of the best chefs across the country are signing up to have their recipes go into our system.
Yeah, it's amazing that how you have taken a longstanding concept of food, you know, obviously drink. We all used to get like cans of Coke or Pepsi out of vending machines, you know, when we were kids or whatever, and then turned it in and just said, like, I'm going to just make this healthy. And part of it is convincing just people that it's something that they'd want to buy, just getting over the stigma. And I assume part of it is your packaging had to look attractive in the vending machines. So they go kind of like, oh, that looks good, I'm going to buy that.
Yeah. I mean, I put so much time into trying to think about how to break the mental model for vending, so that when you looked at the fridge right away, you would think, oh, this is different. So you'd enter the experience thinking about how it was different. At the beginning, it was reclaimed wood and plants, and we had like AstroTurf down in front of the machine and stanchions up because stanchions are in restaurants, not at vending machines. and then over time, as we were scaling it up, we simplified a lot of that and really just brought the food front and center. But that has been, you know, since the beginning, the goal is just like get people over the hurdle. Once they try it, our repeat rates are off the charts. Like 70% of people will actually come back and buy food again. So that part is working.
And did you have an easier time with the younger demographic versus the older?
So a lot of people ask that and assume that our audience is very young. It's actually not. I've bumped into an 80-year-old couple that told me how much they appreciated Farmer's Fridge at the hospital. Oh. And even in our demographic data, you know, our distribution is right there with the population of the US. So, you know, you have your younger audience actually has more time and tends to like not mind waiting in line for lunch or, you know, going out with friends. By the time you've got a couple of kids at home and you're busy and your doctor's telling you to eat better, you're actually like in the bullseye for this. It's really people who don't have time.
Is Chicago, from a food entrepreneur standpoint, a great place to launch a business?
So I've actually commented on this publicly. I think Chicago is the best place to start a food business for multiple reasons. One, the Chicago food ecosystem is the largest and most robust in the country, probably the world. We're in the middle of the breadbasket for the United States, and that means that you have a lot of talent here. We have very affordable industrial space. We have a really diverse labor force that allows us to hire everybody from engineers to food safety experts. And then you have a town that loves food. So you actually have a great audience to try products. So this was obviously McDonald's scaled out of Chicago. All the major food businesses have offices here. Starbucks Second Market was Chicago. So very much Chicago was key to our success. And then geographically, we can reach everyone in the country within 2 days from Chicago.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you, and I don't know if you have these or not, but do you have recommendations of restaurants that kind of are aligned with the type of healthy food that you're providing?
I love restaurants that have like good vegetable menus, and doesn't mean that they're necessarily the healthiest thing, but my number one is probably One-Off Hospitality, and Avec has been since I first moved to Chicago. And then right by my house is a restaurant called Kasama, and they have a mushroom adobo that is like the best vegetarian dish ever. The problem is that their line is so long, I can't even get it anymore. But it's a great restaurant, unbelievable. As far as like healthy restaurants, I think there's been an explosion in healthy QSR type restaurants that are excellent. Like from when I started and there were zero options, but they were starting to emerge. So you had places like Protein Bar, Freshy, we're just getting started. But now you have, you know, places like Roti and Sweetgreen and others that are just doing a great job. And like, it's more expensive, but it's healthy food in more places. On the like dining out side of the equation, I tend to want to treat myself. I eat a Farmer's Fridge salad every day for 10 years. So I could give you great recommendations on like sushi and pizza and, yeah, and right. Other restaurants that I love. But yeah, if I have time to go out for a meal, there's so many good options in Chicago that are not healthy and that I still love. Yeah.
You're not having a salad.
Yeah, I eat the salad so that I can have a cheeseburger and really enjoy that too.
It's all about balance, Luke. You know, it's about balance.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that I ask everybody. So tell me something you absolutely love.
So the thing I absolutely love is sharing food with my kids. Like I have three kids, ages 6 to 6 months, and I have a massive vegetable garden on the roof of our garage, and I have them help me plant it and pick it, and we make things with it. So just cooking for them, taking them out to restaurants, like it's so fun to watch somebody who's never tried anything try something for the first time, and that's what I really just love doing.
Tell me something you can't be without in the kitchen or around food.
when COVID hit, this is probably the best indication, I stocked up on fresh baked bread from the Westtown Bakery that's near my house. And then I put that in the freezer. So while everything was closed, I could have that fresh baked bread. And then butter is probably the number one ingredient, which isn't what you'd expect from a salad guy, but it is in a lot of things and makes everything taste better.
And finally, tell me about one of your all-time favorite food experiences.
So I would say my all-time favorite food experience was I lived in China for about a year in college. And like I think about now, before I pick a meal, I'm like looking at the reviews and trying to pick the absolute best spot. And there, none of that existed. And I could not read the menu half the time. And so it was just an incredible experience to walk into a place and sort of say, you know, what is the stuff on the menu that you recommend?
Right.
And it was really affordable and eclectic. And I loved like just kind of walking in and seeing what like the owner operator chef made and thought I would like. And it was pretty hit or miss, but it was incredible.
What part of China were you in?
I lived in Shanghai and Beijing both.
You can do pretty well on the food scene in both of those towns.
Yeah, it was incredible. Like I would just kind of walk down the street and there'd be like a dumpling shop and you'd walk in. Probably the thing I miss the most is those like fresh made dumplings or soup. Like they would have noodles that they would hand pull right in front of you.
Right.
And that was almost kind of the equivalent of their pizza shop. So you'd walk in and for like a dollar, you'd have a fresh hand pulled noodle soup.
I went to a dumpling place. I was in both those cities and I don't remember which town it was in. They had 1,500 seats, 2,000 seats, and it was packed, right? And they were just pulling, just making dumplings for everyone. It was like so memorable. I was like, wow. And they were fabulous.
Right. Yeah. So that everything about that food experience, because it was totally new and unique and adventurous and everything tasted great. Even when it was a little bit different, I was like, oh, I'm glad I tried this.
Totally. Well, that's great. Listen, Luke, this was so nice talking to you, getting to know you, and congratulations on all this and your 500 plus restaurants. And how many locations are you in now?
We're in 20 markets, everywhere from Los Angeles to New York, Boston, DC, Texas. And we operate in about 750 locations between 550 fridges and then Target, Jewel, and other retail outlets.
That's our show this week. Thanks to Luke Saunders from Farmer's Fridge for sharing his unique journey as a food entrepreneur. You can follow Ali Marotti's reporting on the restaurant beat at chicagobusiness.com. Also, check our show notes for links to all the places we talked about. The Dining Table with David Manilow is produced by Todd Manley at Crane's Audio Studio. And remember to follow us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm David Manilow. We'll keep feeding you the good things in life.